Friday, July 7th, was an offbeat day for life at the ranch. I took a trip, a miniature version of one of my well-planned trips, this time mostly through the old 10th district that Lyndon had represented in Congress for 12 years. And the purpose was to see grassroots beautification and restoration. I'd set the alarm for a little past 7, breakfasted and dressed, and the obliging Mrs. Berg came over and combed my hair. And by 8:20, I was in the chopper, bound for Austin. This was the least advanced trip I had ever made. The idea had laid in the back of my mind ever since I'd first heard of Round Top. And Jake Pickle had been the catalytic agent that had really brought it to life, and we'd set the day a Friday on July 4th when we'd gone to Mrs. Patman's funeral. In a great rush, I had gotten Liz down from Washington, and she had made a small advance run Thursday afternoon. I met Jake and Beryl at Bergstrom about 8:45, and we set out in a car, the bus with Liz, and a fair-sized assortment of press for such a spur-of-the-moment trip had preceded us. There was AP and UP and 2 Houston papers and the Dallas News, a San Antonio paper, and amazingly a Los Angeles one, ABC Network, and, of course, the Austin paper and television. Okay. On the ride to Lockhart, Jake briefed me incessantly, and I read my little press kit. We stepped out of the car into the already baking bright sun in the upper 90s, and the mayor greeted me with an armful of bluebells, which got the day off to a wonderful start. Actually, the whole visit to Lockhart was exciting and filled me with pride that a little Texas town of 6,000 had the determination, the spark, the get-up-and-get to make the most of its courthouse square. In the center, the focal point is the old white limestone Victorian-style courthouse, described by Mr. Zisman, the restoration architect, as a structure ugly enough to be beautiful. There must be at least 100 of them in Texas, built mostly in the 1890s. Unbelievable accumulations of turrets and towers and gingerbread and columns and carvings. It's always the focal point of the town. This one they have augmented by lighting it very artistically, they assured me, and they were all so chagrined that I couldn't be there at night so that I could see the lighting effect. And then, in the square around it, merchants are striving to keep the original character of the turn-of-the-century buildings and still be modern. A young University of Texas architect, student in community and regional planning, had spearheaded the idea, along with Mr. Zisman, had made a very impressive model of the town square in which all the old buildings, circa 1890-1910, with their rather elaborately decorated false fronts, were freshly painted in attractive colors, buff and warm beige and a sort of Indian red and a grayed green, and many of them had brightly striped awnings out front. A number of the merchants had bought the idea and had gone to work painting. There were about 6 finished around the square, and then a row of live oaks down the middle of each street on the side of the square was planned. They'll go in this fall. Some planting had been done on the courthouse square, and a series of tall flagpoles flying the United States flag and the Texas flag were planned. 1 or 2 were already up, and we raised one in front of the best finished building, Westmoreland's, a drugstore that had been in operation for nearly 100 years. It had a handsome new coat of beige paint, and appropriately enough, on top of the false front, the decoration featured an apothecary jar, and the red and white striped awning practically said, "Ice cream parlor, come in." It was an hilarious visit, warm of heart as well as warm of weather. They'd only known I was coming for 2 days, but there was a sizable crowd on the square, and everybody wanted to talk at once and tell me about what they'd been doing. Mayor Dickens, Judge Wilson, young Garland Anderson from the university, and of course Sam Glossman, whom I take to be one of the real leaders of the community. Jake was everywhere at once, wanting me to meet my old friend so-and-so, this good Democrat, and so on. There were nostalgic moments when I met Mrs. Fleetwood Richards, Sr. Her husband had been Lyndon's staunchest supporters in the days when he represented the district, and a lady who'd been Lyndon's secretary in the NYA, and countless people who told me about campaigning with Lyndon in 37 and 46 and so on. The real guts of the day is that the local people themselves had raised the $6,000 for the lighting project of the courthouse, that they were determined to go on. They were proud of their town. Several of them told me with a big smile how many city managers and mayors from other other cities had come to observe and hear about what they had done. We drove past Emmanuel Episcopal Church, the oldest Protestant church in Texas, still having services. There on the grounds I saw a quiet figure with a white mantilla, and someone mentioned rather abashedly that was Mrs. Fallie and that she used to be my roommate. Helen Bird, how awful if we had gone on by and I had not had that fleeting glimpse of her. I asked them if they could stop and run back and get her. So we had the rest of the ride around town together on the front seat, and a moment to hear about her mother, who is very ill, Nancy, her daughter, who raises horses, and the good visit she'd had with Emily Crow about 2 days ago. Twice, when the occasion arose, I found myself quite fluent in being able to describe my delight in this visit, and reminded them of Lyndon's ties here. Not only had he been their congressman for 12 years, but his grandfather and grandmother had lived here. And then we were back in the car and headed for Praha, an old Czech community of which I, professional Central Texan that I am, had never heard until the day before. It turned out to be a jewel. We left the main highway and went down a narrow, winding country road until suddenly before us we saw the two graceful spires of a large, imposing church, quite alone in this serene, pastoral setting. Praha, which is named for Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia, had been settled entirely by Czechs between 1850 and 1870, and had been at one time a community large enough to have 700 families who worshipped in this church. It was built in 1890. Now, all that remains is a general store at the crossroads. The post office is there also, and two or three neat white farmhouses, and the beautiful church, to which thousands of Czechs return, Jake told me, for an annual summer celebration. It is the mother church of all the Czechs in Texas, called St. Mary's. The landscape had become increasingly lush and pretty, rolling, verdant. They must have a great deal more rainfall around here than we do in the hill country, with large live oaks here and there. And several times in meadows we had passed beautiful stands of bluebells, but it was sparsely populated. So it was all the more surprising coming upon this beautiful church out in nowhere to see several hundred people around it, many of them in bright colored Czech costumes, and then the tall, imposing figure of the pastor, Reverend Marcus Anthony Valenta, about 6 feet four, a handsome, strong face, a real commanding figure of a man. He'd been on active battlefield duty longer than any chaplain, from Pearl Harbor to Okinawa. Alas, the poor priest was dressed in his chaplain's uniform, which must have been made for the coldest post he ever had. And as we walked around in the baking sun, it must have been 98, there was sweat dripping off his nose and off his chin, which in no wise detracted from his dignity. A large woman rushed up and pinned a white orchid on me. The priest's sister gave me a handmade sunbonnet, blue and white checked. All the little children in their Czech costumes giggled and crowded around and shook hands. And Jake was introducing me in all directions at once. And then Father Valenta took me into the church, and once more there was a surprise. Its high vaulted ceiling, made of narrow strips of wood, was painted a delicate pastel blue, and completely around the four sides was a garland of flowers and trees in delicate, soft colors. Not a one native to Central Texas. An itinerant artist, long since gone and forgotten, had painted it with considerable charm and skill. But whether the flowers belonged to the Caribbean, or the Mediterranean, or France, or just from some book, I could not tell. There were lilies and ferns, many romantically tropical-looking ones that may have just been his imagination. And then there were large portraits of saints done in a varying degree of skill, one by a former pastor, and one very interesting by a communicant there, a soldier who had been in World War I and had returned to paint his impressions of it. The size and beauty of the church startled me, all the more so because I had never heard of it, and it was in the middle of nowhere. Father Valenta has been here since 55. He showed me the chalice his mother had given him when he was ordained, and it was a beautiful piece of workmanship, combining religious figures that had a special meaning in his life. I was pleased that I recognized a head, a copy of Leonardo da Vinci. And then we were back out into the brilliant sun. Little vignettes that I remember. A line of Head Start youngsters. They were everywhere today. A scrubbed-faced little boy scout who pressed something into my hand. As I moved on with the surging crowd, I looked down. It was a dollar bill, folded dozens of times. He had said, "This is for your beautification project." A band that played under the live oaks and the cemetery itself. Not a name could I read. All in check. The earliest date, 1855. Many of the crosses made of pressed metal, elaborately decorated. A Czech custom, I understand. And nearly all the graves decorated with artificial flowers. There was one special little plot that contained only the graves of veterans. They included one Civil War soldier. I said goodbye and crawled into the bus this time. We were briefed along the way by a member of the Historical Society in the early history and early culture of this area, the influence of the Czechs and of the Germans on it. It's a section rich in history. He kept on saying, a signer of the Declaration of Independence lived here, and a veteran of San Jacinto lived right there. You'd almost think you were in the Virginia of Texas, so full of our early history it was. The land itself looked like Virginia, rolling, verdant, beautiful. It was a little past 12:30 when we got to Monument Hill Park, and along the banks of the Colorado River, the local people had put up tables covered with red checkered tablecloths, and a fish fry was going on. The live oaks in this region are hung with long moss, and there was at least an impression of coolness, which was helped along by great mugs of icy beer, very welcome, along with the fried catfish and black-eyed peas and fried chicken, and thick slabs of homemade bread, and winding up with a typical specialty of the area, kolaches, a pastry that has a center of dried fruit, apricots or prunes. It was a German band going oompa down on the banks of the Colorado. Jake took me around and introduced me to everybody. And I think the courthouse must have been deserted that day because every commissioner, judge, official of all sorts was there. And everybody interested in historical restorations. And the woods are full of them these days in Texas. We're having a renaissance of interest, it seems. I sat next to Judge Petrus and Jake and ate bountifully. In spite of the heat, I find I'm famished on such a trip. Can it be that just receiving and giving out feelings is in itself exhausting? But the high points of the day were still to come, so we hurried on. The next part of the trip was in a sort of jeep, and it was as dusty and difficult as anything at the ranch. We climbed a steep hill from the side of the river through almost tropical thick vegetation, and Judge Petrus kept on pointing out a sheer rising cliff heavily screened by vegetation and saying, "That's where we're going to have our amphitheater." And he went on to explain that this area, through the Early Texas Heritage Foundation, hoped to raise some $350,000 to build a 700-seat outdoor theater to show a pageant about early Texas history. Paul Green had been there and was interested in writing the script. Sam Seldon, Emily's husband, had visited just two or three days before, had assured him, our young guide told me, that it was an ideal spot for an amphitheater. And as the scenery and the tale expanded, I could agree that the potential was great, and so were the obstacles. The one thing, it's so far off the beaten path. We wound our way up the mountainside to an early Texas brewery, long since deserted and overgrown by vegetation. It had been started there around Civil War times by a German pioneer family. They were excellent stonemasons, and the remains of their building, office, vats, storerooms, can still be seen. The site was chosen because of the clear, good springs where the water comes rushing down the mountain, and it also furnished power for whatever they needed. They had taken out their product by ox wagon and flatboat down the Colorado to be sold in San Antonio and Gonzales and all over Central and South Texas, and it had been a flourishing business for four or more decades. The old patriarch of the family believed that beer was at its best at room temperature, and the advent of refrigeration and the coming of a railroad close by, making it possible to get in other brands, did not change his mind. He refused to refrigerate his, and gradually his customers dropped off, and his brewery became a ghost house. He closed down with rooms still full, and as we climbed the hill, we came to his home, which was a very impressive building of stone, the work beautifully done, a long porch running along its front. It was almost at the top of Monument Hill, and there was a drop-off behind it, sheer down into a beautiful rolling valley where you could see the Colorado River curving along and a bridge arching over it. What a sight this would be for an eating place. I'm not the first person to have thought of it. Mrs. Bobby said later that they had urged her to go in and restore it. But putting a restaurant there poses so many problems. But the end of the old German family, the Kreisches, was weird indeed. After their business closed, the father of the family died soon after, and the mother kept all the daughters at home, refused to let them go anywhere, and so they lived out their lives, recluses. And then we were in Monument Park, dedicated by Sam Houston himself, the first Texas state park. I'm not sure just when, I believe in early 1860. It's called Monument Park because the bodies of the men who had been on the Dawson expedition and the Mier expedition, both those who had drawn the black beans and been shot and buried in Salado, Mexico, and those that had returned to live out their lives in this area, were buried here. And over them, there is a tall obelisk, resembling but smaller than the Washington Monument. And on one face of it are painted, I don't know the medium, the faces of the pioneers that are represented there. It's quite interestingly done, but the setting is what makes it great. To stand there on this bluff and look down into the valley. Right down below us, halfway along the bluff, they told me, was the backdrop of the amphitheater. The perfect shell, a hollow, for the seats could range around it. Once more, I thought the potential was exciting, and the doing of it very fraught with problems. This time we drove on in the car, Jake and Judge Petrus and I, and barely stopped at the old facing house on the outskirts of LaGrange. The garden club ladies have done it over, and it is a charming example of a Victorian cottage, reminding me at once of Lyndon's boyhood home, except a much fancier one, delightful gingerbread. I did take time to run quickly to the door and congratulate the hostess of the garden club ladies and tell her how much I wished I could go inside. And then it was a rush back to another courthouse square scene. This one is equally Victorian, equally bizarre. This time, the courthouse square, which is already graced with some very handsome live oak trees and pecan trees, has a completed and rather impressive planting, to which I added one more thing, a pine tree. It's one of the lost pines that begin about Bastrop and continue down this way, separated by many miles and also by the variety from any other stands of pine, of great interest to the botanist. Here, there was a sizable crowd, much meeting of officials. I was presented with a history of Fayette County, and there was a group of Head Start children and a lot of Negroes in this crowd, as they had been at Lockhart. There was a brief speech under a treaty oak, and I remember the photographers kept on looking at the thermometer on a building which said 98 degrees and wanting to get that in the background. I'd spent a part of the day urging all the men in sight to take off their coats. But actually, we hadn't yet arrived at what was the main destination of the day, and so we hurried on. The next stop was in Warrenton, and here Mrs. Bobby met me in front of the William Neese home. I had considered omitting it. I'm so glad I didn't. This old house, abandoned, dilapidated, still had about it an air of gracious elegance. Two-story, with a veranda running the full length of the second floor. It became more and more interesting as I explored. The whole second floor was a ballroom. It had been a sort of a community meeting place, with an elaborately painted and stenciled ceiling by Matthias Melchior, a German craftsman of the 1860s, I believe, whose three sons had also been stencilers and painters. The ceiling had representations of the four seasons, delicate and elegant. It was interesting to imagine the life lived here by the William Neeses and their neighbors, what the ladies wore as they danced under the candle chandelier, and later it must have been color, or walked out on the balcony to the wrought iron railing, what they talked about and did for a living. I believe it was in this house that I saw the signature, full of curlicues, of Matthias Melchior, carefully preserved, where he'd put it on one of the walls to attest to future generations that this was his work. Mrs. Bobby goes about this in a very scholarly fashion. She's done research about every phase of the workmanship and has trained workers in restoring it in the way that it was done 100 years ago. Texas is fortunate to have somebody that knows as much, cares as much, and has the money to do it. This is one of about 10 or more houses that she is currently working on. None of them have reached completion, and what she is going to do to make them available to the public is not clear to me, perhaps not even to her yet. Mrs. Bobby accompanied me on to Winedale, which was just a few miles down the road, and had been completely, perfectly restored by Miss Irma Hogg, who met me, complete with hat and gloves, at the front door, 85 years old, and very active and articulate. Winedale is a long, two-storied building, verandas running the full length and columns, soft beige in appearance and a little brown trim. It's a restored Stagecoach Inn, a stopping place for travelers 130 years ago. Miss Irma bought it and supervised the restoration and presented it to the University of Texas as a center for the study of architectural history, in particular of the German settlers in Texas and their intellectual and social impact on Texas. Here, Wayne Bell, the restoration advisor of the university, took over, debriefed the press, but it was Miss Irma that I followed through the house, as she pointed out the exceedingly wide boards of cedar, doesn't grow that big anymore, used in the walls, the Biedermeier furniture, much of it made locally, some they had brought from Pennsylvania, the bright, elaborate quilts on the beds, one of them she called the Yankee quilt, was made during the Civil War, and was full of patriotic figures of the stars and stripes, such insignia. And in an upstairs room on the wall, a very ornate wreath of silver and another of gold, framed and glass-covered, of course, that had been worn at the silver wedding anniversary and the golden wedding anniversary of the family that had owned this house. They had been brought from Germany, and it was the custom of that day. Here, too, there was stenciling and painting on the wall, evidence of the work of the same Melchior family. I asked the young lady who accompanied us and had been introduced as hostess how many visitors they had per day, and I was distressed to hear that they had about 120 a week, and it is open 4 days a week. But of course it has only been open a year or less. It is part of what will be a little complex. There's another old restored home, air-conditioned, we heard, available for students in residence doing research on German architecture and early settlers. And there's also a barn equipped for a theater in the round and any sort of public meetings, and at present housing a rather wonderful collection of Schuett's drawings of Texas scenes. We went to the outside kitchen, replete with the usual items of churn and waffle iron on a long stick, and they've even started growing grapes once more. This was named Winedale because the Germans had grown grapes and made wine in fairly sizable quantity in their early days here, though the industry has long since disappeared. Most interesting of all to me, I think, was Miss Irma herself, her knowledge and devotion. We're really pretty sophisticated about the whole thing, we Texans. For instance, the young University of Texas architect Wayne Bell was leaving tonight for Winnetour for continued study. And then, at last, came what we had really started out to see, Round Top. I drove back with Mrs. Bobby, and we spent an hour and a half in this small community of about 100, center of which is a little town hall, where, complete with flag and Boy Scouts and bands, we had yet another welcoming ceremony, and a few words by the mayor and me. Then a walking tour with two guides, Mr. Bannock and Mrs. Bobby. There was one little complex that Mrs. Ledbetter had restored, the only really complete thing there. Three buildings, one of which was a charming antique shop in which I could have lingered. There was the old volunteer fire department, the ancient equipment out front. The most interesting thing was a house in the process of being restored. Again, Mrs. Bobby's handiwork. And there was a room here in which the entire walls were covered with stenciling. Out front, craftsmen that she had trained were doing the work in the manner of the mid-19th century German craftsmen. She has them go to the woods, cut down trees that fit their specifications, haul them in and do it right on the job in the manner of the Melchiors of 1850. He's establishing a scholarship in John Ben Shepherd's name to train young men in restoration work. Interestingly, some passing artist many years ago had done a sketch of this house, and it shows a small oak tree in the front, a mere sapling, and now this tree is enormous in girth. The old picture is the outside of the little brochure about Round Top. Several Houston people, Miss Irma, Mrs. Bobby, and a family named Nielsen, spend their summers in restored homes here. We went in the Nielsens, where the ladies of the garden club welcomed us. The Nielsens were not at home, and it's a ready subject for house and garden. A charming blending of the authentic picturesque old with the very livable new, and a view out the window of pastures and meadows that would haunt you when you went back to Houston. Everywhere there were bluebells. And then we went on to the Lutheran Church, over 100 years old, where someone was playing the pipe organ made entirely of cedar. A German craftsman in the area, 100 years ago, had made 5 such organs. This one, at least, still worked beautifully. Then we stopped by the community's social hall, where the ladies had set out big bowls of punch and pots of hot coffee and all sorts of delicious German cookies, coffee cakes, and pastries. Everything here was as German as it had been Czech at Praha. There were at least a dozen vases of bluebells in the room. Once again, I was famished and had some of everything. I did a little tape about the day's journey for the editor of the Brenham paper, whom I recognized from the days that Lennon had been in Congress. And then we made our last goodbyes, and John Ben Shepherd and I got in the car and drove straight to Bergstrom, an hour's journey, and then by chopper to the ranch, arriving a little after 7. What a full and marvelous day it had been. One vignette that remains in my life is the painters up on ladders busily painting away at the storefronts in Lockhart. We waved at every one of them. Most of them didn't even wave back. They were so busy. We took John Ben down to the Cedar House to see Patrick Linden. Lucy had gone into Austin to make preparations for Patrick's birthday, which is Sunday. And then, in mass, we went to the hills for dinner. Linden and I, and John Ben, Jim, Mary, Marie, and Ashton. It's really been hilarious. When anyone out here asks for dinner, we come as a package, varying from 6 to 12. Our hosts, the Wests and Crims and Hills and Morsons, seem to find that quite natural. A.W. and Mary Ellen were there. There are few lovelier settings in the hill country than this house on a bluff overlooking the Pernellis. And sunset is a marvelous time there. We sat on the porch with drinks and hors d'oeuvres, and the twilight waned into dark before we went into the living room, where 8 of us sat by candlelight around the long, imposing table that must have come from a Spanish monastery, and the rest were in the dining area. It's always a good dinner, and a completely uninhibited appetite. Poor Linden, poor me. When we get back, I shall have to live off of hard-boiled eggs and black coffee. But for now, I'll live it up. We watched the news on TV and left the hills a little before 11, arriving at the ranch for an early and very welcome bedtime.